This is Faster Forward from Northern Trust Asset Servicing, where we explore stories, insights, and lessons learned from leaders and innovators that are driving transformation across their industries.
This is Faster Forward from Northern Trust Asset Servicing. In this podcast, we explore stories, insights, and lessons learned from leaders and innovators who are driving transformation across their industries. I'm Patrice Sikora. And joining us today is Carl Boneri, Head of Engineering and Data Science, Front Office Analytics at Northern Trust. Carl will be discussing his career path, the increasingly critical role that data, AI, and machine learning are playing in today's world, how Northern Trust is helping clients unlock and organize their data to create actionable insights, what the future of technology may be, and much more. There must be much more here. Carl, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we get into the discussion about all of this, though, tell us about you and your journey to your current role at Northern Trust.
Sure, and thanks for having me, Patrice. So career-wise, started out in finance. This was 2007. So for a few of us, I'm sure they can imagine what the next year brought, which meant a pivot in my career very swiftly come 2008. After 2008, I transitioned into more of an operationally minded field. So I was restructuring organizations and preparing them for sale. So a big part of that job was looking for operational efficiencies, going in and physically making them on the ground, and also looking for new revenue opportunities for the businesses themselves. During that, I think, portion of my career is when I really started focusing on analytics and decisive information that could be derived from data. It was enabling me to make decisions that were going to be impactful more swiftly. And I really discovered that not only did I enjoy that part of the opportunity and role more than the rest, but it was also staggeringly taking up most of my time. So in order to make a swift decision, I found that I would spend, 10 to 20 times the amount of time collecting, organizing the data, putting it together, and then very briefly spending time on putting together the formula or the algorithm that I needed to have the data run through so that I could go make a swift decision and know that I was doing so with all of the granularity that may be involved in understanding optics across convoluted or complex arenas, what have you. You're trying to derive information from lots and lots of data points. So that's when the transition to focusing more on the tech side of my background came into play and really deep dove into the engineering side of things. At that point, I became technical founder of a cognitive computing startup. That startup was focused on natural language processing, which I think most of the time today would be tagged to LLMs and things like that. This was a good few years ago. So at the time, sentiment analysis was the big thing. And rather than sentiment, I felt that focusing on the context of conversations would give you much more valuable insight into the why behind an action. So our clients were hedge funds who invested in the film space. So we helped build audiences based on narratives of scripts to help determine what would the outcome at the box office be, for instance. And we had a gathering of clients across a few different sectors. So that's kind of the background, fast forward to leading up to Northern Trust.
So you were playing with a pseudo AI way back when?
Yeah, so it's funny you say it that way. One of the things that's always stuck out to me, and I'm not the best about this, but we've used different verbiage or buzzwords, I think we'd call them, over time. And it started with, big data, and then it moved into data science, and then machine learning came about, and now it's AI. Under the hood, most of this is still linear regression, but it's incredible to see how far things have come in such a short period of time, for sure.
All right. Well, before we get any further, let's take a step back. It might be helpful for you to explain your view of data.
Oof, loaded question. Very big one there. So I think people tend to think of data in different terms. You could simplify it to it is information that is processed or stored and then presented in another form or fashion to an engineer or to a database administrator. It may mean something totally different than it means to yourself. Like, how do you think about data, Patrice? When the word data gets brought up, what kind of materializes in your head?
Basically, is it data or is it data?
Fantastic. So There you go. And this goes into even contextual stuff, right? So I think I was going for more of what, like a shape of data or how it's accessed, or does that even cross people's minds? So I think there's lots of differing ways to look at it. When I think of data, I think of it as a source of potential intelligence. And what I mean by that is, as a quote unquote data scientist or an analyst or quant, realistically, I think of data as not being intelligence in and of itself. I think of it as information that's been translated into binary digital format. And I'm sure we just lost half the audience to sleep. But if you kind of stick with me, if information is going to be the source of knowledge and we gain intelligence, or we garner it rather, from a body of knowledge, then that is what gets us to decision making. Data in most cases is a burden and not a benefit. Because unless it's, organized, processed, and available to the right people to make that decision, it's going to be prohibitive. And I think that is a very real scenario that we face in most circumstances these days.
That is a TED Talk topic right there.
Oh, yikes.
I think you
I'm
should
sure
write
there's
that
tons
down.
of them.
No, I think
I'm
you should
sure
write
there's,
that one
well,
down.
to be fair, most of that is stolen from a quote that I came across years ago. And more specifically, I think the quote, and I'm going to misquote it, but it's, data is not intelligence, blah, blah, blah. And burden, not a benefit, is kind of where it wraps up. And that really struck me when I came across it, because at the time we were building extraordinarily complex algorithms, and we were doing so on very powerful cloud systems. Like we had all of the resources in place to execute some pretty big questions that we were asking of information. And it was still 90% of the time was spent formulating how to organize chaosed data and get it into a shape where it could communicate with itself, so that we could, in fact, then run it through whatever it was going to be that got us that derived information. And that's what got us to the decisions, and that's what got our clients to their actual value. And in the hedge fund space, you'll hear us refer to that as alpha, but it really comes down to kind of the same simplistic problems and patterns, where it's data comes in all shapes and sizes. It's coming from all different sources. You said yourself, is it data or data? Someone's data might be data. Another person's may be data. Our job is to marry those two at all times and teach them that they're one and the same.
Wow, I love that. And how does it, when it's organized and processed and available, how does it help you leverage like AI, as we were mentioning, and then machine learning?
This is a really fun question for me, because probably not a popular sentiment. I tend to think of machine learning and AI and processing data like this in very practical senses. So to kind of tie this back to our day-to-day life at Northern and what my team does, there are so many boundaries, or I guess you would say barriers to entry for our clients who are extraordinarily sophisticated, extraordinarily complex, have their own systems. And a practical implementation of AI and machine learning in our space is simply teaching data to recognize itself within other bodies of data. When we think about onboarding clients, right, we need to first make their data match our system status so that they can communicate and flow freely. Most approaches to this historically would be something of what we would refer to as a data contract. Basically, hey, here's the shape of our data, here's the namings of our mechanisms. Please match yours to ours. Seems straightforward, right? When you really look under the hood and you understand the scale and size of this data, it's massive. So applying AI and teaching one data point to recognize itself in another data set is extraordinarily low-hanging fruit and not that impressive. But the value that's derived from that is unlocking the humans involved to move on to the more complex scenarios. Let's talk about how you calculate this certain exposure, because in finance, we have different models to do so. And each client may have a different interpretation of it, or they may have a different agreement in place with their fund subscribers for how that gets done. And this is exponential. I think one of the best approaches or use cases, and it starts at the ground level with your data strategy, and something that I think you'll hear referred to as data lineage, sometimes gets confused with data governance, but we'll come back to that. So data lineage is being able to see a piece of information that travels through multiple systems and the information that it gets married with, and then where does that married data then interact with other data points? So if you can kind of think about it like looking down at a city grid from above an airplane when you're about to land, you know, in Chicago, for instance, and you're watching cars go through the grid, you've got a good vantage point from up in the sky. You can see each individual set of lights. You can see where they're turning. But if you're on the ground and you're behind, you know, the next block, it's very difficult, yet impossible, to really understand or see that same thing, right? So if you think in terms of a data system being designed so that each point is observable and where it travels to and what it does, you then unlock the ability to operate on it across the board. This is where AI and ML really come into play with what they can do. It's like giving them the best opportunity to be successful in simplistic forms. So if throwing AI at a messy data system is equatable to putting a Band-Aid on a very large open wound, you're still going to get some benefit from the AI, right? If it's our Band-Aid in this scenario. But if you give it the best opportunity and you've given it clean information so that it can do what it's meant to do, the value return is just not comparable to what I think we're seeing a lot of the solutions return today. And we can both agree those are still very impressive, but it's like arming somebody with knowledge. If I arm somebody with a body of knowledge, they're going to be more impactful when they go out to exert that knowledge on whatever audience it becomes their target, right? If I'm sending them out there with the Cliff's notes, they're only going to get so far. And I think that's where we tend to be in the marketplace right now. And so practical application, as I put it, translates probably to starting at the root of all of this, introducing simple, reusable patterns that allow your data to communicate with itself no matter where it goes inside of your systems and organization, really does unlock everything else on the layers up. And it's boring to talk about, but it's kind of where most of my life has been spent. So I would like to fix that problem selfishly for myself so that I can go have the fun, which is building things like the ML and the AI model.
I don't find it boring at all. And this is a little esoteric, but you say data is not intelligent. Well, then how is it the artificial intelligence that helps to give it the ability to see itself, to recognize itself?
That's the fun part of this one is that is, if we think about it as being able to measure a statistical difference between two things, right? The human eye, we see apple, orange, we know those are different things, right? Two data points are represented in binary format as zeros and ones, right? So we may see 1, 2, 3 in field A in a table, and we may see 1, 2, 3 in field Z in another table. Our eye is going to say, well, those 1, 2, 3s are the same. I wonder if the next row in that table in those fields is also the same. Therefore, these are the same things. One is data and the other one is data. They're the same things. And therefore, like that, I'm looking at the same thing. So what lives next to each of those in their own bins that's different from source to source? How do those combine to derive new information? And at what point am I so far away from those two things being similar that it's no longer statistically important? That's how we kind of determine programmatically what something should be equatable to in another place. Now, here's where the AI and ML become really powerful. A really oversimplification of this is AI, ML, these are trained data sets. It's not really making decision. It comes down to like logic and observability. So if all things in programming can get boiled down to an if-else statement, right? If this, then that, else, do this. You're teaching it how to handle different situations, just like you would teach a child, right? We hope to educate our youth with like, if this situation occurs, do this. If not, do that. And then they learn on their own because they derive information from the world around them because we've taught them the basics. That's what intelligent data is, realistically. It's data that is given the ability to learn from itself and new data that enters its ecosystem. And you've then rewarded it over time so that it trains itself. Then it becomes capable of doing things that's far different than anything we would have taught it to do day one. And the explosion of AI in recent years is, you know, predicated predominantly on the fact that we've had a couple of years of training data in massive quantities. Now, admittedly, things like ChatGPT, that's one of the most incredible feats of technology I've ever, that one baffles the mind. It's just humbling to even compare yourself in a field like that similarly, because the first time I looked at it, I was like, I have no clue how they did that. That's absolutely incredible. I have no idea. It's cool. I have no clue. So I don't know if that answers your question. This would probably be where I get tangential, because it's something that I think about in terms of if all things are causality and all things interact with each other to create new actions. I think of data in the same way that I think of human interactions, in the same way that I think of financial markets. All things have a catalyst and all things become reactionary, and it's chaos. And you don't need to tame chaos. You just need to observe it and get good enough to kind of funnel it.
Excellent. So we're going to get tangential again here.
Oh, cool.
Why did you choose to continue your career with Northern Trust? What made you do that?
I am very fortunate to work with a group of the smartest people that I've ever encountered in my life. The team that was pitched to me was this very unique, very interesting skunkworks sort. So the conversation, obviously, for them became about how do we get, you know, you're at a startup that you are the head of data science, you are the founder, you have a board seat. How do we get you to come to Northern Trust, kind of a deal? And I don't think it was much of, sorry, that sounded very arrogant. It wasn't like that at all. It was the startup mentality was obvious that was kind of where I was. And Northern Trust is a very large global enterprise. The two operational models are vastly different, right? One is tried and true and consistent and, you know, has time-tested processes and large groups of people involved in decisions. The other is move as fast as you can, break it all, it doesn't matter, right? You're all in. And the team that I'm on today is the scaled up, I would say, eventual maturity of where we started. So when we first began, it was like five of us. And we were this little skunkworks team that sat in hedge fund services, HFS, middle office. And the way it was presented to me was we solve the most complex problems. We are the combination of business and engineering. I think it goes without saying, there's a divide between technical prowess and business prowess traditionally, especially in fintech, financial technology services, whereby there's not a lot of people who know what to do with the information, how to do it, and where the information is and what the information is. And like I said, there was five of us. And I think they've reached this velocity whereby the complexity of the solutions that they were then being presented meant that they needed a little bit more sophistication in the engineering prowess. And so the niche that I brought was, yes, the finance background, so I understand similarly to them what I'm looking at. I think I introduced the data science portion, but the large scale systems architecture, deep understanding of not just data layers and how to build cloud, but really the architecture that makes it all work well together. And so I hate to use the word sophistication, but it blended well with their level of sophistication in the other arenas, so that we became kind of this harmony of blended skill sets where we were all a little bit of each other, but each of us had this like really dominating arena of focus. I mean, you had a PhD in econometric modeling. It's just some of the smartest people I was very humbled to join Northern Trust, quite honestly. And it was fun because to me, solving complexity at large scale is kind of the driver. And Northern Trust is one of the biggest players in the game and in the hedge fund space. It doesn't get more impactful than working with, you know, honestly, finance at that scale. We play in global markets. There's complexity all over the place. And barrier to entry in our space to really solve problems end to end is access to data. And Northern Trust is at the scale where that data exists. So moved to Chicago, come jump in this little fun skunkworks. I joined. I went from my really exactly what you'd probably picture startup office in a loft with monitors everywhere in this old renovated warehouse, to a floor of cubicles. And I loved every minute of it. And this was December of 2019. So much like my start in finance in 2007, I very swiftly transitioned to a different lifestyle.
Yes.
So that was it. The team that I joined was this little skunk works that was going to solve super complex problems. Everybody I spoke with on that team was, I just blew me away. We had a lot of fun instantly. And it was just the right fit, the right time. So I jumped in head first. And now 4 years later, we're 50 to 60 on the team. We oversee the investment analytics umbrella in the hedge fund space, both for kind of how we help hedge funds make decisions and for the technology that blends it. So again, we've kept that ethos and that culture of business and technology are one and the same. We've been fortunate to attract like-minded people, sometimes stealing them from other teams when we see certain things, and foster that within the group and watch it replicate itself. And that's been really fun.
Well, you've been breaking down the barriers between tech and finance.
Well, I think that's a fun, that's a lofty tagline. I think instead of breaking down the barriers, I think we're starting to really illuminate the fact that that barrier is diminishing as a result of the changing access to technology in the world. There's not going to be a single finance person that coming out of school or somebody whose focus is anything in quantitative finance or economics who hasn't written Python, who hasn't been asked to code. If we think about you or I, we're both very young. When we were in grade school, there was no programming class. That wasn't a thing, right? Access, that was not, it wasn't part of our daily vocabulary. And now it is. And so with that has come this, body of people who have this expertise, but who also have a technical understanding. And so that's a natural diminisher of that barrier. If you then mix that with, people of a certain mentality and mindset who are very hard-headed about solving problems and who enjoy the rush of the complexity and scale, you kind of end up with our team. So it's an interesting mix of people for sure. But it's a lot of fun. And again, we've been very successful in replicating and kind of establishing this culture. We face off against clients. We help solve problems globally. And our goal is to just solve problems. And so that's where our team has kind of always remained mentally.
Talk to me about governance, data governance. How's that changed?
Sure. So data governance within an enterprise of our size is often thought of as kind of the back office, right? The prohibitive, the you can't do this. The truth is it's a vital piece of the life cycle. Certain clients have certain subscriptions to data services. Therefore, they can only use that data. But if that data is blended into a massive pooling of data, right? Or, we refer to them as lakes or whatever. Then how do you determine who's getting what data? How do you ensure that that data is safe? We talk about things like PII or personally identifiable information. We talk about things like cybersecurity, but we don't really think about them in the same way that we think about raw data, but they're one and the same. How you store it, how it gets distributed, that becomes kind of your data governance, but it can be so much more than that, because if you go all the way back to the beginning of our conversation about being able to capture the root of when that data enters your life, like when that piece of data enters your world, if you've interacted with it, you know exactly what it is, no matter where it goes, who it interacts with, what it's going to do or become, you've captured that quote unquote, like manifest is what we'd refer to it as. And that is where governance can also weaponize the large body of people. So I work on a team of 50. I work in an enterprise of close to 30,000. Everybody's got their own different data systems because that's a natural way of building out a globally scaled enterprise, right? There's multiple offerings. We've got wealth management, we've got asset management, we've got family office. Everybody has different types of data. There's central body of governance becomes about knowing where and what the data is at huge scale. So if you look at it as kind of the defensive or if you look at it from a defensive aspect of governing the data, making sure the right people are using the data, making sure that the data is protected and safe. And I don't mean to use a tone there. That's just, I'm trying to predicate this point. Mm-hmm. right? Then that's one thing. But if you kind of flip it on its head and you say, well, interestingly enough, if data governance represents the notion that there's optics across all the data, then data governance could also then give you lineage and accessibility across the board. They know what should go where, but also within data, there's this. Metadata is just as valuable as the data itself. And metadata is what we use to describe what the data is, not necessarily, or, you know, actually, this is a really hard thing to kind of compare. If I can see what a data point is normally interacting with for a certain analysis in wealth management, and I can see that that data is combined in a really unique way, and I'm formulating something where that would be insightful to the model that I'm building, two things are happening. A, we have to hope I'm smart enough to know that that insight would really add value to what I'm building for a client, right? So that's you got to rely on the individual human. Mm-hmm. But also, if I don't know it exists, but I do know what to do with it, should I know it exists, now all of a sudden, I've unlocked myself to deliver new value. And I don't need to know what the data body looks like. I don't need to have access to all that information. But just being able to draw that line across all the different data silos is going to empower people to have new ideas, bring cool things to the market faster, bring value to our clients. Because that's at the end of the day, what we're trying to deliver is how do we help our clients who are experts be more expert with their information? And this becomes about unlocking individuals, empowering them to have more fun at work, right? You're going to get more satisfaction the more you build things. For data scientists, for quants, people like myself, finding information is so prohibitive and so hard that it's frustrating and it's very personal. That frustration level is very personal. This goes back to the 95% of your life is spent finding data and munging data and this, that, and the other. The fact of the matter is that, again, there are people that know what to do with this information. And data systems historically are not built to make everything discoverable to them. So looking at governance as a lake house, to equate it to lake terminology we use, whereby that lake house has observability across all the lakes, right? It doesn't mean it needs to own the data that's in those lakes. It doesn't mean it needs to touch it, but it can see mm-hmm. where everything is. And if I have a question of data, right, and I live somewhere in another ecosystem, I can ask the lake house. I don't have to go around to each individual lake that the lake house can see and ask the same question, right? I can go to one central place like a library in the past. I don't know if that's going to strike a lot of the audience, but we all knew if we had to prepare a report or gather information, we went one place to go get it. We went and we pulled out those drawers that had the cards in them.
The card
we
catalog.
Looked alphabetically. Yeah. That's right. The card catalog. Data governance can be thought of like a card catalog when you look at a lakehouse strategy. Now, obviously, that's a small component of it, but I tend to think in terms of both offense and defense. I mean, I'm in risk and compliance, but I work for clients who are asking for this information so that they can capitalize on it. So I think naturally I come by it that way.
You mentioned clients a couple of times now. What do you see as some of the biggest issues that they are looking to solve?
Oof, man, depends on the day. So we, again, my team has this very unique operating model whereby like we also face off against the clients. So, you know, we're not just waiting on requirements. We're not just going out into the market trying to attract clients. We are on a daily deliverable for them in many, many different areas. We are onboarding them. We tend to think of ourselves as, if our clients are experts, they come to our team to be their experts too. We see ourselves as an extension of their desk. When I say desk, we refer to desk in our field as, so I think of it as a trading block. Or hedge funds that we work with are very large. And so they tend to be what are referred to as fund of funds. And so that's mm-hmm. a hedge fund made up of many hedge funds. We like to make things complex in finance. We use a lot of acronyms. So I'll try to keep this as broad stroke as possible. Each one of those is going to have its own focus, but there will have personas within their body of employees, basically. It's a risk officer, a risk desk, right? And then you'll have your CIO and your chief compliance officer. And just, we work with very large funds. That's where kind of our arena lives. So the problems that they're looking to solve And their barriers to entry, starting in the very beginning with onboarding. Earlier, we talked about onboarding a client's data. When you think about onboarding an extraordinarily large client, like the type that Northern Trust Asset Servicing is built to service very large clients. That's what we're built for. We're also built for the very small ones, to be fair. We have different offering lanes for that. But to onboard them means, think in terms of this, they've gotten to their size not on accident. They will have hundreds, if not thousands of employees. They are looking to Northern Trust as an outsourced service provider, as their experts, but also as their custodian. So what that means is that all of the systems that they have built over the years, all of the data flows, the Excel workbooks, and I'm sure they are, I promise you, they are mostly Excel workbooks. And that is not to denigrate anything, right? That is how we have done things mostly leading up to today. And it's because the barrier to technology is incredibly hard. In our space, we're finance experts. Why would we be technology experts? We outsource that. We look at it from a cost-benefit stance, right? And if we don't know enough to drive the technology that we need to unlock us, we don't know the right questions to ask of the people that can build that intelligence for us. Again, that's where our team really, really comes in and is in like our sweet spot, is understanding the client and the tech side so much so that we can help them ask the right question and kind of provide our insight as they're trying to go through this onboarding. And so the barrier becomes all of their massive data needs to first come into our world. That process, there is no way I can tell you how big of a barrier that is or what a big pain point that is. Clients who manage more than $200 billion, they're going to have a lot of data. They're going to have a lot of people. They're going to have a lot of systems. They're going to choose their partner over multiple years. And then to onboard them is going to take another multiple of years. There are going to be many people involved. There are going to be many consultants. As you go through this process, the hardest part is blending their information with ours, having it funnel through, making that Rosetta Stone, so to speak, and then seamlessly making sure that it's both going back to them and is being properly calculated. That's what we specialize in. That's what we do. That's why clients choose us. AI and machine learning can reduce the friction for that very first part. The value add there is tremendous. And again, that's a practical application, so it's not fun to talk about, but it's a very big lift if you get it right. And so that's kind of the things that I want to focus with. The other things that clients are asking us for, how do we make our day-to-day lives easier with systems? How do we automate and drive this? So a big focus, and I know this kind of goes off topic a little bit, but being right is vital in my area. Predictive analytics, having AI, tell me what's happening in the future if I'm running some sort of a risk model. So when we talk about risk models, a big service that we provide to our clients is risk scenario modeling. Tell me what's going to happen to my entire financial insight or outlook predicated on things that have happened in the past, right? So you build scenarios. What did the markets look like for 9/11, for savings and loan? What did they look like in 2008? What did they look like in the dot-com bubble? Blending this and then understanding what's my value at risk, right? That's something we talk about a lot as VAR, value at risk. And what does my window or my timelines look like? Because there's so much complexity with hedge funds that a lot of people don't understand. They have arrangements with people who have given them money, whereby they might not be able to liquidate over X amount of days. And if they do, they've broken their agreement. Therefore, other clients can come pull their money out. And if your whole strategy is predicated on a length of time and all things being held consistent, when you get from A to Z, the payouts at Z, if people can exit in the middle of that, it's gonna blow your whole thing up. So we focus on everything from the start to the end and the in-between. We see them asking for tooling that unlocks their people because their people are experts too. Again, barrier is access to data that is clean, relatable, meaning it's easily joined and it's transparent. So AI, ML, that's the stuff that gets you all of the action at the top of it. Focusing on the root of it is what unlocks the rest. we spend a lot of our time in that middle area. And that's why I think for us, a big focus is that route.
Carl, for you, what is the most exciting part of your job?
Oof, waking up and figuring out what sort of violence everybody else decided to choose that morning. The most exciting part about my job. On the one hand, us building up this team based on, I mentioned the five of us kind of in the beginning, we fell into sync. It was like people I'd known my whole life, not just close friends, but understood each other and understood what we wanted to do. And we could run in any direction and not even touch base with each other and know that we were all handling the same things that needed to be handled in each of our niches that were going to get us where we wanted to go next or help us solve that problem. And that's really what it has always been about, is solving problems, not where we wanted to go or what we wanted to become. It was just, we want to solve problems. That's what we enjoy. As the team has scaled out, I think one of the things I have found I enjoy the most is working with the newer members and watching them. These are brilliant people. They come in with incredible skills. It's very hard for us to recruit to our team. When you get a team of people like that together, coming to a singular right approach can be difficult, right? It's like putting five all-stars in a room together. When everybody's used to being that person, it can be tricky. And so an ethos that we developed was everybody is both right. One person will probably be the person who helps you pick apart the decision that's going to be right, but it doesn't mean their decision was wrong. So put that another way is we believe in communicating on this team. We believe in asking questions. Nobody is so intelligent that they know everything. In fact, everything needs to be approached as if we know enough to know we can't know everything. So be humble. You don't have to be right all the time. But because we have to be right all the time as a team, you have to be willing to admit when you don't know something. So you got to come to the group. And I think it's just a great way to be, is just because your decision or your idea isn't the one that's being chosen doesn't mean you were wrong. It means that you helped us bulletproof the decision that we're moving forward with. So seeing that and our culture and the work ethic of everybody that has joined this team is really kind of, that's the most, it's one of the most exciting things about this. And that's kind of like the fostering mentality of people and seeing, you know, I'll wax poetic about how important data is, right? And gosh, there's a lot of people that don't want to hear me talk about that. And I get that, that's fine. But watching patterns and paradigms take hold on people and then watching what they do with it is really rewarding. And watching this team grow in its sophistication, we go back to the blend of engineering and business, right? The sophistication of the engineering at this point is what you would expect a fan. It's incredible to see the types of systems and builds that are happening right now. It's not just solving tactical problems with tactical and quick solutions. These are enterprise scale, wildly impressive architecture builds. And so that's been really rewarding. I think the exciting thing for me is where we go next with it. I'm watching as the mentality is taking hold because it is becoming more prevalent in the market that there is a gap the barrier between business and engineering is diminishing. We have to start thinking about these things together and seeing how we can implement things like AI and ML properly into our day-to-day lives and having that become just muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And so we can focus on the more complex stuff, knowing that that's just right. Right? We're going to use AI and ML to just know that the foundations are right. And we kind of preach simplicity and elegance, right? I like to oversimplify things for myself because, you know, that's just kind of my approach to things. Common sense rather than book smart, I guess is how I would put it. I tend to back all the way out of a problem and think about it in terms of least common denominators that things are shared. So solve for the universe of chaos, not by trying to wrangle it, right? But guide it. And so you build little elegant solutions along the way that can be put together, not just for that problem, but you can reuse those components to solve the next problem. And this starts to give you very good scale, but it also gives you consistency. Knowing that those things are just tried and true and time tested and marrying that with a, some might say, oversimplified data strategy means that we are free to build and solve more complex things more swiftly. and we can service our clients better, which means that we can capture more market. I don't know if we're allowed to say that on this, but that's the other fun part of this job is you do want to be the best. Who are we kidding, right? Like nobody gets into finance because they don't have a little bit of that in their brain. That's the most exciting part. So all of it and none of it, Patrice.
All right, well, as we get close to wrapping this up, I want you to wax a little more poetic about what you see coming in the next 3 years for technology and data.
I see LLMs really being baked into everything as the translation layer. If the barrier between unlocking what data and systems can do for humans is turning those into queries of the data, right? You and I use a language that a computer doesn't naturally equate to bring me this, right? Where we're seeing LLMs really come a long way. And again, it's kind of like the boring thing that no one talks about. But translating human speech and inputs into SQL queries that are vastly accurate and can be executed, but also if you apply that to then a clean data layer underneath it, I see that unlocking a person's ability to simply ask questions of its data, just like you would with, you know, a ChatGPT kind of a thing. But if I'm a CIO, if I'm a chief risk officer, if I'm a head of risk, and I need to make a decision swiftly and know that it's accurate, and I can simply speak what's on my mind, and I don't have to go through these, you know, because there's going to be rigidity introduced if I've programmed you a solution to allow you to configure a question versus if I can freeform ask a question and get back my answer. It's huge. I think that's a big one. And I think AI is going to give us what we're kind of all looking for in many ways, right? Which is more of us back, more time for us to make decisions with our expertise. So rather than like, what can AI do for us? It's more of moving to a question of what is this going to enable us to do? And that's kind of where I see this now.
To wrap it up then, one last question for you. You got a final thought here? Final thought on for our audience with regard to how they can drive their personal and professional lives faster forward. So one final thought for our audience.
Don't get caught up in the rhetoric of AI and machine learning will solve it all. It's going to solve for a lot, right? But just like everything throughout history, it comes down to consistent, simple core. It all starts at the root. And so organized and readily accessible information is what unlocks all of this. If we approach everything like, well, we'll just throw AI at it, we're not going to get far. Mm-hmm. We're going to mitigate and we're going to do some stuff, right? You might get a PDF recommendation when you write an email, like, oh, that's cool. But realistically, what could you do with your time if machine learning, artificial intelligence were truly unlocked to take a lot of the burdensome daily steps of your life out of the equation, and you were free to execute on what you knew to execute best on?
Carl, that was fantastic. Thank you. It was a lot of great information today. I learned.
Oh, good.
And I'm sure our listeners learned a lot too. I am excited to see what's coming up with machine learning, with AI. Thanks so much, Carl. And thank you, listeners, for listening to Faster Forward from Northern Trust Asset Servicing.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Subscribe to Faster Forward from your favorite podcast app to be automatically notified of new episodes. This audio podcast is being provided for informational and educational purposes only and is not meant to be taken as investment advice or a recommendation of any specific investment product or strategy. The information does not take your financial situation, investment objective, or risk tolerance into consideration. Listeners, including professionals, should under no circumstances rely upon this information as a substitute for their own research or for obtaining specific legal, investment, accounting, or tax advice from their own counsel. Northern Trust Corporation, Head Office 50 South LaSalle Street, Chicago, Illinois, 60603. USA Incorporated with limited liability in the U.S.